Welcome to Next Level Healing. I'm your host, Dr. Tara Perry. For 25 years, I've helped professionals, first responders, celebrities, Olympians, teachers, moms, dads, and people just like you achieve their results better and faster than they thought possible. This is where measurable modern science meets the quantum. We're so glad you're here. Let's dive right in. Hey, everybody. Welcome to this episode of Next Level Healing. I'm your host, Dr. Tara Perry. I'm thrilled at my guest today. His name is Tim Shields. He is an artist, a writer specifically. And just like Hemingway was obsessed with hard living and Steinbeck with migrant movement, since age 17, he's been obsessed with consciousness and the nature of creation. The manifestation of this dream has afforded Tim the opportunity to collaborate with professional athletes, rock stars, and global thought leaders in the fields of science and spirituality. For 6 years, he served as Dr. Joe Dispenza's editor, which included working on Becoming Supernatural, How Common People Are Doing the Uncommon. Obviously, anybody who's listened to the show knows that I'm a huge Dr. Joe fan, so I'm super excited to dive in here. Other collaborations of Tim's include Harry Massey, Mandy Cavanaugh, and Dr. Tobias Moeller-Bertram, known as Dr. Toby. We see him at a lot at the Dr. Joe events. And currently Dr. Zach Bush, another superhero of mine. Tim is the author of A Curious Year in the Great Vivarium Experiment, and the course, The 13 Keys, A New Model for Living, Dreaming, and Creating. Tim's passion resides in educating, teaching, and writing about humanity's creative potential at the intersections of consciousness, quantum physics, healing, and transformation. This is the super playground, which I love. Welcome to Next Level Healing, Tim Shields.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
So take us back in time. You know, how did you first realize this was your passion? Take us through the journey.
Well, I'm sure like a lot of people's story, I could say it started at a Grateful Dead concert on a heroic dose of mushrooms, not really knowing what I was doing. Had no idea, was totally innocent, naive. And, you know, I would say I had the language now, I didn't have it then, but I would say I experienced unity consciousness for the first time. And 17 was also an important age because I started keeping a journal and I decided I wanted to be a writer. And I wanted to be a writer so bad, I started asking whoever or whatever was watching or conducting this orchestra to be used as an instrument of peace. I just wanted to be a writer so bad, I was just like, speak through me, speak through me. You know, and then you get into your 20s, and I was living in New York and just chasing dot-com busts and partying. And then probably around 35, I remembered, I was like, oh, wow, I used to ask to be used as an instrument of peace all the time. And I started doing it again. And then it was like, boom, I connected with Dr. Joe Dispenza.
Wow. I love the book, Becoming Supernatural. I've read all of his books. As soon as I discovered Dr. Joe, actually, it's kind of a funny story. A patient of mine was coming back from Costa Rica and sat next to him in first class and texted me when she landed at LAX that she had just spent 5 hours next to Joe Dispenza.
Oh my
and
gosh.
I didn't know who he was, so I looked him up. And as soon as I read his story, I thought, wow, this man is really exceptional. And since then, I read all of his books and told all my patients about him and started meditating and started getting them meditating. So what was that experience like for you being part of that groundbreaking book?
Well, it was a dream because it was actually my first, it was my first real break. I was kind of stuck for years in corporate America. You know, my soul slowly withering away. And I went to my first Dr. Joe Dispenza event in 2010, and there was probably 100 people there. And my sisters took me. So during one of the sessions, one of my sisters kept standing up because she had hurt her back sleigh riding with her child. And he's like, "What are you doing?" She's like, "Oh my God, am I in trouble?" He's like, she told him the story, and he said, "Well, let's go find a room." And it turned out that before I was born, my family lived one town over from his family in New Jersey. So it was like, you went to Alfonso's Pizza? I went to Alfonso's Pizza, blah, blah, blah. You know, and then he invited us to be guests. And I was trying to put my first sort of book effort out into the world at that time. And he thought he could track down this literary agent for me. And we just kind of stayed in touch. And I would go to a workshop about once a year. And every time I saw him, I was like, we'd be great collaborators. And then I think in 2015, I went to my first sort of advanced workshop. There were four days at that time. And I wanted to create a mentor and a full-time job because I was always freelancing. So every time a job ended, I had to change my energy, look for a new work when I was trying to create this, my first book. So everybody was having these super profound internal experiences and I'm beating myself up the whole time. I'm like, I'm doing it wrong, like, you know. And as soon as I landed in Seattle, I opened my phone and I got a LinkedIn message about this job that was supposed to be like the next unicorn company. And I thought to myself, well, that's interesting. And then I took the light rail into Seattle and I ran into this guy on the street. And he's like, you really have to apply to this job. And I said, okay, sure. Long story short, I wind up getting the job. Every day before work for 6 months, I went to a coffee shop to work on the first draft of, to finish the first draft of A Curious Year in the Great Vivarium Experiment. It took me exactly 6 months. And when I finished the draft, I was like, oh my God, I think I have a real book here. And exactly at that moment, I wound up getting laid off. And I was just like, yes, I'm going to work on this book all winter. And I literally walked out of the building and I said out loud, I said, what amazing thing's about to happen to me? And probably within 3 minutes, I got a text from Dr. Joe Dispenza's assistant and said, Dr. Joe's in the Middle East, but he'd like to schedule a call with you about helping him with his blogs. And I was like, oh my God, I can't believe this is happening. And so anyway, I started helping him with his blogs. And then 9 months later, he asked me to work on Becoming Supernatural. And I literally said to him, watch how fucking fast I quit my job. And that was it. I quit my job and I never went back.
Wow. Hey guys, studies are showing that 68% of people that watch podcasts regularly don't click the subscribe button. Do me a huge favor. If you like this content, click subscribe so other people know where to go for the cool stuff. Thank you.
We actually recently did a show called, was on quantum jumping. It looks like you did a quantum jump there.
I guess so. You know, I kept at the first workshop, he said, turn to the person next to you and tell them how much you're going to commit to meditating. And I was like, oh my God, maybe once a week or something. And I don't know. A lot was going on in my life. My mother was sort of, you know, she was in bad shape. She passed away, I don't know, 6 months later, and I just started meditating every day and I started seeing results in my life. And then around 2015, I committed to a daily practice. Of course, now this is the first time in my life I've really fallen out of it, but I feel like a lot of my day is a meditative practice. But I just saw, you know, the results, and I realized that, oh, I don't have to have this profound internal experience. I just have to do the work. And that's going to be reflected. I witness it constantly reflected in my external world. So, I mean, I've created so much through Dr. Joe's work, including connecting with Dr. Zach Bush. I had put him in a Mind Movie, and it said underneath, I work with the best people in the world. And it took 26 months to manifest, but I got invited to this small research event at UCSD, and Dr. Zach Bush was there, and there was only about 14 people, and I was prepared to stalk him like a cheetah stalking a gazelle on the Serengeti. I'm just like watching him the whole time, and we were walking to the lab, and he turned to me and he said, "So how are you involved?" And I was like, "I was trying to come up with something clever, and I had nothing," and I literally said, "Well, I'm trying to come up with something clever, but I have nothing." And my friend Hillary said, oh, he used to be Dr. Joe Dispenza's editor. And he just said, really? Are you available right now? And I said, as a matter of fact, I am. And, you know, before we even got to the lab, he asked me for my phone number. And, you know, it's been a very long process, but I have the contract in my court finally. Took about 10 plus months. He's obviously an incredibly busy guy, traveling all over the world and everything. So yeah, the last 10 months, 11 months, 2 years, depending on how you, 3 weeks, depending on how you cut it, has really taught me, which I'm not very good at, patience, but I'm working on it.
So how long have you been working with Dr. Bush?
Well, I mean, we worked on a book proposal. So that's the beginning of our working relationship. And then we got a book deal, and now we're just working out sort of what the rest of this looks like.
Phenomenal. All these guys, I totally appreciate their work, and I've forwarded countless Dr. Joe and Dr. Zach Bush videos, and I love the 8-minute mind-blowing one where he revives three people in a weekend and they all say the same thing, which is, why did you bring me back?
Yeah.
And here he is.
Oh, that's one of my favorite ones. Yeah.
And here
I always send that one to people.
Here he is being this hero, thinking he's just done the greatest thing in the world, and these people had experienced more peace and love and acceptance in transitioning than they had known in their entire lives, and they were not at all in a hurry to come back.
Yeah, because one of his three, I don't know what the, I'm lacking the word right now, but he was an endocrinologist and also end of life care and something else. So he was dealing with hospice people all the time. So he got to see that last moment.
And one thing I love about him, and I watched a video that he did, which was very similar to one that Dr. Stephen Gundry did. They both sort of highlighted how, you know, because he was saving people all the time, and he felt like he was pulling them out of a river. And one day he looked upstream and he's like, well, why are all these people getting thrown in the river in the first place?
Yeah.
So as you know, he's deeply committed to enriching the soil, because when factory farming came along, chronic disease and illness went up just lockstep with factory farming. So that makes an interesting thing to look at. Can you comment on that? Because you're obviously involved with him, you're involved with his work. What has your take been on this? What is your exposure to that?
You know, we're really just getting started, but I mean, in this 10 months, I listened to every single podcast I could. I was taking notes of his stories and what they correlate to. But I just feel incredibly connected to him. And, you know, I get to work with these people, and I'm kind of an amalgam machine. So, you know, the work, the 13 keys, is really, Dr. Joe is definitely the biggest input. I'm already coming up with ideas for the follow-up to this, but I have a feeling it's going to be, Zach is going to be this huge input. You know, everybody I work with, I kind of get a new toolbox of language.
Mm-hmm.
So Zach, I'm really going to learn about biology and energy and really deep into the cell. I'm super excited. I've just been chomping at the bit the whole time. I'm like, can we get this going? I don't even need a contract. Let's just get this going.
He always seemed to have the 50,000 foot view, which I always appreciated so much. Tell us about the 13 keys. How did you, how was it born? You know, what's the impetus behind it? What's the status of it currently?
Well, I was pitching this book proposal. And I got introduced to, I think, the senior vice president at William Morris Endeavor. And I thought, oh my God, this is my big chance. And I sort of wrote this very consciousness forward pitch letter to somebody that works in Hollywood. And he's just like, I'm sorry, I don't understand this. And I put a lot of work
I used
into
to
this.
Work at CAA.
Oh, no way.
Yes, okay. Before I incarnated into the holistic healthcare world, this was many moons ago. I swam in those waters for a while, and I can understand what you're... In fact, that's one of the reasons I left, is because I looked around and I didn't see a lot of happy people.
Yeah.
So anyway, continue.
So I was pretty bummed out about it, but now, as I've gotten older, I, you know, the faster you can shift your energy, the faster the solution shows up. And I moped for a couple hours, and then I always just say out loud, I'm like, all right, show me what's better. And I just happened to jump on this Clubhouse app. Like, Clubhouse was the thing for a while during COVID and all that. I saw a guy who was running the room, and he introduced me, and this woman started talking to me, and she said, well, can I talk to you offline? I have a deal with Hay House. And I said, sure. So we wound up becoming friends, and she said, I really think you should meet my agent. And I said, okay, whatever. I'll talk to him. I go for a hike. I come back. He's already reached out to me. He asked to talk to me the next morning. By the end of the conversation, he had sent me a contract. I didn't sign it for like 10 months, but we wound up going out to lunch, and I handed him this stack of papers, and I asked him what he liked, and he actually chose the one that I liked best. And it was the first, I had just finished a bulk of work for Dr. Toby, and it was the first time that I've ever been able to focus solely on my own work. And so I just set about following where this thread was leading me. I had no idea what I was writing about. And I would kind of come to the end of a chapter, and I would go for this hike on this Native American land up here and ask what I needed to know. And it was like, the information would just come in, and I'd be like walking around scribbling like in this canyon. And so anyway, it turned into a book called The 13 Keys, A Memoir from the Future. And we started to pitch it. And then I started working with a professional tennis player, and my agent said, let's sell this one first, and then we'll focus on selling yours. Anyway, I just fell off of it. And then I went to Europe, and I wound up having a pretty profound experience over there. So I thought, okay, I need to add one more chapter, which would make 13. And then my agent wound up getting sick, and he eventually passed away. And I wound up looking up what the number 13 means and all this stuff, and it kind of blew my mind. It's almost like a number that's been intentionally hidden from us. So that's kind of part of the prologue. But since I was in this whole holding pattern, somebody suggested I start teaching the work before it even comes out. So I thought, okay, I'll start to do some Zoom calls or something. As soon as I turned into it, all these people started showing up, including like a film crew and stuff. So I decided to turn it into a course. And I just launched the course, and now I'm actually teaching it on Sundays. So really, you know, in the divine comedy of the divine, it's my work has completely evolved from what it was 2 years ago. Different title, different table of contents. And then now I'm forced to, you know, first I had to translate it from a book into video, and now I'm translating it from a video into teaching in person. So, you know, at the core of it, my work is surrender and trust, because that's what I'm trying to master. And at the deepest soul level, I have that. But, you know, then there's that human strata, and you're just like, is this really ever going to happen? What's going on? But I mean, luckily, when you're young, you don't have the body, the life experience to understand that there's something greater leading you. And, you know, I say intelligence is the ability to recognize patterns. And I've seen this pattern continue throughout my life. And it's, you know, you get put in a holding pattern, and you might be trying to manifest or create three things. And because time isn't linear, all of a sudden they just line up in one day. And it's like, boom, you're off to the races. So I'm just in the holding pattern. I'm in the transformation chamber. I'm trying to bust out of the chrysalis, but try not to put too much effort into it. Just allowing and receiving.
Recognizing patterns is seriously powerful. I think anybody who knows Tony Robbins' work says that, his claim to fame is not that he's a motivator. It's that he's a pattern recognizer. Because if you can recognize the patterns, then you can leverage things so that you more quickly and easily go from where you are to where you want to go. So is this course available to people yet? It sounds like it's in the incubator period.
No, it was just launched. It's libthe13keys.com.
So walk us through what somebody's experience would be like with that and some of the stories of people who have gone through it. What have they shifted and changed?
Well, the people that filmed it, they wound up breaking up because it brought a lot of things to the surface. It's kind of, so the book is, my first book is about the dream of the 17-year-old self. And then this book is me 3 decades in the future talking to my 17-year-old self and telling him everything I've learned about consciousness and everything like that. So it's some pretty deep material, but my skill is translating this complex material into consumable, relatable, understandable, actionable information. So it's kind of just this narrative. And like I said, I didn't know where it was going. And when I got to the end of it, I was just kind of in awe that I was guided on this path in this way. And that's the creative process. You know, it's not a linear process. Anytime I've tried to start with a table of contents with somebody, you know, it morphs into something completely different because you have to allow this thing to unfold or this new story or this new thread and then just follow it with curiosity. You know, today I'm redoing my book proposal right now because I'm about to start pitching it again. And I think it's going to work into it, but I was kind of reading about the Knights Templar. I was learning about the Knights Templar, and they were attacked on Friday the 13th, I think 1307, and they were protecting all of this information and technology that was supposed to have come from Atlantis, and they were protecting, despite the fact that they were hired by the church, they were trying to keep it from the church and the king because it's so powerful. Whoever contained this information would be able to devastate their enemies if it fell in the wrong hands. So I just kind of thought, isn't that interesting? Friday the 13th, and this number 13 has been bastardized. And I made the leap. I don't know if it's going to work in the narrative yet, but it's almost like that was one of many kind of attempts to disconnect us from this natural order and from this higher information, free energy, everything that would change the world. So, you know, 13, there's so much to 13. There's 13 steps on, in Egyptian mythology, there's 13 steps on the ladder. And once you reach the top, you complete your karmic cycle. There was 12 apostles and Jesus, that's 13, which represents the all and the one, the 12 archetypes knowing itself. On the back of a tortoise shell, there's 28 panels around the exterior and 13 in the middle, which is 364, which, you know, that also equates to a woman's cycle.
And it has to do with the Fibonacci sequence too, doesn't it?
I think so. Yeah. Well, for sure. Yeah. And it's just kind of never ending. 13 represents the birth, death, and ascension cycle. It represents the divine feminine. And then, actually, this is kind of how the title came about. I was listening to a podcast with Robert Edward Grant, and he was saying that when you start drawing sacred geometry, it unlocks your pineal gland. So one Sunday night, I said, okay, I'm going to try and draw Metatron's cube. Started drawing it. The next day, the new title comes in, the new table of contents, all this stuff. And then on Thursday, I tried to draw it again. And when I was drawing it, I realized Metatron's cube is made of 13 circles.
Wow.
And all of the platonic solids come out of that, which are the structures of everything that's created in the universe. And when Archangel Metatron, he's not in Christian mythology, but he's in the Talmud and the Book of Enoch and a bunch of others. When he's depicted with Metatron's cube. And Metatron is said to be the only archangel who was also a human. And he is the scribe of humanity. So he's invested in our health and healing. And what Metatron's cube represents is health, the health of humanity.
Fascinating.
It's a big rabbit hole I started.
Are you familiar with a fellow named Peter Plikta? I've recently met somebody who's very into these number things, and he writes about this, and I'm curious to know if there's any connection. Also, Da Vinci wrote backwards because it also unlocked various creative pathways. Is there any connection there, or are you familiar with that?
I do know about that, but I don't include it in this. I mean, sometimes I haven't done it in a long time, but if I would be stuck, I would write with my left hand because it slows things down and you're using a different side of the brain. But no connection to any of that stuff. It's just another trick and tool to kind of unlock information.
That's fascinating. You mentioned a thought in your first book, and it's a question I love to ask on the show a lot. If you were to go back and talk to your 17-year-old self, what would you say to your 17-year-old self?
Well, this is one of the pillars of the book. And simply put, chill the fuck out. Stop being, you know, and my mother actually wrote me this letter in college, and it's stop being in such a rush for the future. Mm. It comes all too soon and it sorts itself out. So actually during lockdown one, I was working with somebody in New Braunfels, Texas, which is in between San Antonio and Austin. And obviously there was nothing to do but write, cook, whatever. And so, but there, she had this little private beach club down by the Guadalupe River. And we had just been discussing Maslow's hierarchy of needs that day. And I'm walking down the river by myself, and this image of concentric circles pops into my head. And I was like, wow, that's interesting. That makes so much more sense for self-actualization than it existing at the tip of a triangle. If we took it literally, if it was at the tip of a triangle, it would suggest it was a linear state. From self-actualization is a linear state from which there is no deviation or fall. So I wound up creating this thing I call the circlotron, and it's my model of self-actualization. So in two dimensions, just on a piece of paper, it's a roadmap of your life's journey. In three dimensions, it's actually an information grid that explains how we connect to the people we connect to in this life.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And what are the practical ways that people can connect to this, dial into it, utilize it? What does your day look like? How are you, you know, what do you, some of the patterns that you seem to have are to let go, first ask, and then to let go. Yeah. And that seems to be a way that you've consistently manifested some really out of the box, beautiful experiences, totally in alignment with what you want. So if you were to give people a checklist of, I don't know, 3, 4, or 5 things to do or not do each day, what would that look like?
Well, the thing that I started doing in October 2010, after my mother passed away, I thought I was ready, but she had Parkinson's and dementia. So I had been preparing myself, and then she passed away. It was like the rug was swept out of my underneath me, and I was totally lost. I had no idea what I was doing. And I talked to my sister's friend, who was a, you know, like an energy healer. And she said, okay, you're a writer. I want you to do this exercise every day. I want you to write down 5 things you intend to create, and or 5 things you're grateful for and 5 things you want to create. And you're going to find that the things you create today are going to be the things you are grateful for in the future. So I just started writing this, you know, I just started writing this stuff down. I was like, I'm desperate. I'll try anything. And things just started manifesting immediately. I wasn't working at the time. I got the perfect job, you know, surrounded by right people. It allowed me to make a chunk of money. And then I told them at 6 months, I said, but I'm done. I'm taking off to India, which was what my first book is about. And right before I left, he said, would you be interested in working 10 to 20 hours a week while you're traveling? I was like, hell yeah, I would. American money in India goes a long way.
I did that in China.
Yeah. And then I had miles. So at 3 months, I flew home to surprise my family for a family reunion. And I flew through Seattle and I stopped in the office, and my boss just pulled me aside. I was there for 2 or 3 days, and he pulled me aside, and he like whispered, he's like, bill me for 40 hours a week for the last 3 months of your contract. So then I went, I had that. And then I went back to China to help a friend who has like, he used to have this business where he was the school photographer at international schools. You know, I also wrote, I always write specifically, I intend and create.
Yep.
And I said, I want to be of service while I travel. And I wound up connecting with this guy. I said yes to volunteering at an eco ashram, not even knowing what it was. I thought
this was
going to be
in China or in India?
This was in India.
Okay,
the first 3 months were in India.
Okay.
And I just, I thought I was going to be sweeping floors and making beds. And it turns out he was India's most important environmental lawyer. The grandfather of environmental law of India sued the state of India over 20 years to create a green zone around the Taj Mahal. Every Friday for years, the Supreme Court of India held special cases for him, for the voiceless people of India and the environment. And I just got to tag along with this guy for about a month and a half. And one American scientist I met over there said, this is the most important lawyer in India since Gandhi.
Wow.
And I just got to hang out with him. And he was like the most beautiful, gentle soul with the most amazing laugh. But he was just a terror in the courtroom to anybody who faced him. And he would only take cases that he knew he could win. And he had like 100 landmark environmental cases in India. And, you know, very, very blessed to run across these people in my life.
How much time total did you spend in India? And what other countries have you been to?
I spent 3 months in India. And then on that trip, I traveled for 15 months and I was in China, Laos, Cambodia, Sri Lanka, Vietnam. The last 3 months I lived in Berlin. I could have kept going because I kept manifesting so much stuff. And at one point I was like, I'm tired. I want my own bed. At some point I'm going to have to start my life over again. The last opportunity was I could have toured with this children's group that was being backed by Black Lady Mombasa, which was Paul Simon's backing band on Graceland. But I was kind of, I was like, this is a pretty cool, amazing experience. They wanted me to do the social media.
Love it.
For this tour. But I got to go home.
So what would be some insights you have about consciousness from different cultures around the world?
I mean, it's all the same thing. It's all about oneness. And, you know, I really think that who you are being is a mirror to what you experience in the external world. And, you know, I've gotten to the point, like I said before, when something bad happens, I'm like, okay, like I might wallow in it for a bit, but then I say, show me what's better. And I change my energy as well. I move from disappointment, fear, lack, whatever, into, okay, surprise me, trust me. And I'm continuously surprised by how quickly, you know, that shift in my internal energy is mirrored in my external world by the serendipities, synchronicities, opportunities, right people, right time that show up. So
have you always found the serendipities? Do you find that as you practice this and get better at it, that the serendipities happen more quickly, or how does that shift and change over time?
Not necessarily. Like I said, because the universe is not linear and there's sort of a divine plan. It's almost like, what's that called? You know those ancient counting machines that have
abacus?
It's almost like you're waiting for the right colors to line up.
Mm.
And sometimes that takes a long time. I mean, it took me 26 months to work with Zach Bush, but I heard him the first time and I was like, who is this guy? I want to learn from him. Something I'm learning, I'm working on a second book with my friend Mandy Cavanaugh, who I worked on one during lockdown with. And this is about leadership. It's about conscious leadership. I think it's going to be a pretty profound book, but something I'm learning right now about, and this was one of her mentors, Robert Tennyson Stevens, mm-hmm. is conscious language.
Mm.
and the way, you know, with the way language actually sculpts our external reality as
well.
So
powerful. So powerful.
Yeah.
It's like in the beginning there was the word, and then the word is really important.
I think that's the opening of this book. Yeah. I thought something that was interesting in this, and I was just writing about it before our call, was the Hopi language didn't have a word for time and space.
Mm.
They didn't understand. It just didn't matter. Like, life was just one continuous dynamic process. I found that to be pretty, pretty profound.
In one of the recent interviews I did, it was with Chris Niebauer, who wrote No Self, No Problem, and he talks about the Pitaha, and very similar, they are very, we're very left brain, we're very categorized, we're very linear, and the Pitaha are not that way at all. They're very in the present moment. Their language is even almost more of a song than actual language. It's fascinating. We also interviewed Jill Bolte Taylor, who had the stroke of the left hemisphere, and her experience of life without that left hemisphere was that of bliss, of joy, of not knowing where her body started and the rest of the world started, where her body stopped and the rest of the world started. There's only one problem, is it's really hard to function in 3D reality. So
yeah,
it's kind of, you know, how do you juggle these different parts of you and get that synergy and that, she calls it a brain huddle, where the whole brain is working together rather than fighting itself and not understanding itself. What would your thoughts and languaging around that be?
Well, I mean, I think we got to get out of our brains and into our hearts. You know, the brain is full of trickery, and it begins with the programming and conditioning of our parents and then our environments and then media and everything else. And, you know, I think, and this is part of the 13 keys, the only way out of this shit show is the evolution of consciousness. And it's happening. People are, you know, consciousness is a wave, and people are waking up in mass, I think. And part of we're working on this book called Creator Civilization, A Leadership Mandate for the 21st Century. And part of the premise is that old school leadership is becoming obsolete, because they're just speaking fear, division, separation. And these younger people, digital natives and everything, they grew up in a paradigm of connectedness because of their understanding of the internet.
Mm.
So they're just not buying into this, you know, these messages. And, you know, people gotta wake up, or they're gonna lose their following. I mean, nobody trusts the government or, you know, leadership anyway at this point. Maybe RFK, I think RFK Jr. is kind of an example of what we talk about in this book, you know, and speaking from love and humility and everything. And he's one of the only people I've ever heard a politician say, I don't know enough about that at this moment. I'm going to do some research and I'm going to get back to you. Everyone else just bullshits their way through, you know, selling us lies and
he's quite the researcher. And you had said something earlier that totally reminded me of him, and that was about the lawyer that you were hanging out with in India. You know, RFK is famous for suing municipalities for polluting the environment and winning, which is a big key cornerstone of his life.
Yeah, I mean, he cleaned up the most polluted waterway, the Hudson River Valley, in the country. Mm-hmm. And now it's one of the cleanest waterways, created this whole thing called the River Keepers and everything like that. You know, I have friends who won't listen to him because they've been programmed through the media about the vaccines and all this stuff. And it's like, no, that's not it. Listen to his origin story.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's like a dream to have like a politician that's actually educated and can speak on science and philosophy and, you know, history. I mean, the downfall of maybe humanity, probably the United States, is that we have such a short memory of history.
Actually,
we're not applying these lessons of the past.
Yeah. Are you familiar?
And they're so recent.
Are you familiar with Mark Gober? He talks about that in his books too. That we have a very much of our institutions have a very, very short recollection of history, because history does tend to repeat itself. And those who don't learn from it are condemned to repeat it.
I Absolutely. I mean, in Plato's Republic, we were supposed to have like enlightened people leading us, and they're most of them are the most dim-witted, you know, self, you know, they're just out for themselves and everything like that. But yeah, I didn't.
So when you talk about really... collectively us waking up, what do you think are like the biggest keys to this global wake up that hopefully is occurring?
Well, I mean, I keep saying, you know, in this course, it's about going within. It's about disconnecting from the external world. You know, the mind thinks, the heart knows. I think, you know, Dr. Joe says something like that. But we just have to realize that we're one, and we've been sold a lie that we've been divided into all of, you know, the more you can divide a people, the less powerful they are. And we're being divided by politics, by race, by gender, by everything else. And all people have to do is just wake up and realize that's a lie. And, you know, the power is in the people. And that power actually exists in the collective consciousness. We're all one. So you can think of it either as a bank metaphor or as the cloud metaphor, but I guess we're making deposits and withdrawals all the time from the collective consciousness. And so we have to be aware of what's in the collective consciousness, otherwise we're pulling that in. But if we are the spark that is putting better things into the collective consciousness, it's almost like a mathematics game. And at some point, you know, it's already happening. If the last 3 or 4 years have shown us anything, it's the systems we're living in that are against us, and they're crumbling because they're ineffective. Yeah. So
as Mark Gober says, he wrote An End to Upside Down Thinking, which is all about quantum physics and consciousness. And ultimately, if you realize that we are all one, then you don't treat anything or anybody differently than you would treat yourself, because they are you.
Exactly. Yeah. You harm others, you're harming yourself on almost an atomic level.
So when you went back in time and would advise your 17-year-old self to lighten up and take things easier, what is the experience of life when you follow these principles? You know, I imagine it's lighter, it's more joyful, it's more fun. How would you characterize that transition?
Well, I'm in total flow, and I'm receiving information that I don't think my simple little brain could come up with. Sometimes I'll be writing and I'm just banging on the desk like, holy shit, like I can't believe this is coming through. And for me, you know, that's the place where I almost feel most alive in life. When I have a great writing day, I'm lit up. And it's really because I'm receiving a stream of information that is, I guess we could say, highly energized, elevated, we could say. And you know, it's my prayer almost. It's my prayer and my meditation. It's my connection to the divine. Some people, you know, they can get it in running or a relationship or painting. But me, you know, I actually have, I think it's T8 or something like that, but it's called The Practice as the Way. And, you know, for me, writing has been a way of carving out a path to God or source or whatever you want to wrap language around the engendering force of the universe. So, you know, it's like you keep doing the practice no matter what it is. Even if you're a soccer player, you shoot 1,000 penalty shots for that one time. But, you know, every time I get into that state, I'm coming into more alignment with who I am, my higher self, what I'm here to do. And I mean, there was a couple times like I moved to Mexico for a woman, didn't work out, met somebody else, didn't work out again down there. And I came back and I was just like, screw this. I just want routine. I want to make a ton of money. I'm just going to go to Amazon And, you know, that process was very full of friction, put it that way. And every time I've tried to get off the writing train, life was like, just pushes me right back on. And when I finally just surrendered, I remember walking out of my apartment one day in Seattle, and I go, all right, I guess this is what I'm supposed to do. I got a phone call, you know, in about 15 minutes that led me to my first agent. And actually, this woman just reached out to me after 4 years, about two or three Sundays ago. And she said, I keep getting messages for you from my guides. And I was like, all right, lay it on me. And I said, I'm doing this teaching at 2 o'clock, you know, join the call and then we can talk afterwards. And she was basically telling me that she thinks my target audience is like young men, you know, 25 to 35, people who are connected, awake, but they're, you know, devastated by the state of the world. The last thing they want to do is sit in a company for, you know, 20 or 30 years. And so I think it's that entire generation of digital natives, but it would make sense, men, because what I'm writing is the guidance that I wish somebody had given me when I was 17, because I didn't have any mentors. You know, people didn't talk like this. You know, nobody in my family had sort of carved out a path to be an artist. And I don't even know where
we're starting. It's so funny and so how beautiful how many of us are discovering what we're discovering and then going back and providing a helping hand to people that were like us when we were younger.
Yeah. I mean, this.
So how do you want people to get in touch with you? How do they find out more about your work? Where do people go who are inspired and want to develop these keys that you're talking about?
You can find the course at livethe13keys.com. My personal website is therealtimshields.com. It's also my Instagram, TikTok, which I'm kind of starting to play with. My first book is acuriousyear.com. And there's a beautiful book trailer that was filmed in India, and my nephew scored the trailer and created the soundtrack. He's a musician in Nashville now. He did that when he was 19.
And where can people see that?
Acuriousyear.com.
Okay, great.
Yeah. So I think that's a great book for people who are sort of, you know, it's a story and we're wired for story. And I actually, every couple chapters is a real gratitude intention exercise that I did, because that is what formed the story arc. I wrote these things down and it happened and it created. I would urge everybody to do that. People who read that book, like, reach out to me all the time and they're like, I started doing this exercise. You're not going to believe what happened. I was like, yeah, I kind of do believe it. But I'm also always in awe when it happens. So that book is a really good way to kind of understand consciousness from a beginner's perspective.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being with us on Next Level Healing today. Folks, he is the author of A Curious Year in the Great Vivarium Experiment and the course The 13 Keys, A New Model for Living, Dreaming, and Creating. Thank you so much for being here on Next Level Healing, Tim Shields.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Next Level Healing. Please like, subscribe, and let us know how this helped you. How can it be even more life-changing? We love hearing from you. And if you're eager to upgrade your life, click the button here or go to consulttara.com and get your free customized GPS map. Get the coordinates for where you are now and where you want to go. Clients consistently report it's faster and easier than they thought possible. Remember, you were meant for more, and it is available to you. See you right here next week for our next episode.